The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I learned that she just started writing at 13. And she was published, the Icarus Girl, which I hope a lot of you have gotten a chance to read, at 19. And last June, she graduated from Cambridge, and her major was not English. It was, in fact, social and political science. And this fall, she is going to Columbia and study creative writing, as if she needs to. So, I hope you had a chance to take a look at her work, read it. She's going to read a little bit for you. And I was really struck when I had a chance to really get into the book, because it really does take you to some really interesting places. And the religion that she goes into, how she got interested in it, she was sort of looking at it, and she noticed in the Cuban legends there were a lot of Yoruba words. So, you know, it's interesting how she put it all together, and I'm sure that you will be entertained by her tonight. I would like you to welcome Helen Oyeyemi.
Hello. Hello. Okay, I'm just going to read from the beginning of the novel. Well, there are two beginnings. There's one beginning with a goddess, a Santeria goddess, in fact, who lives in a somewhere house that has two doors, and one door opens out into Lagos in Nigeria, and the other door opens out into London. But I'm not going to read from that. I'm going to read from the other beginning, which is the beginning of Maha, who is the daughter of two Cuban immigrants. Living in London, and she just found out that she's pregnant. Okay. His last name shall be his father's name. His second name shall be his grandfather's name. His first name shall be a name for his own self. But unknown to him, all those fathers before his grandfather live in this name. That is something a mother has the power to do to her son. Anyhow, I'm going to be a terrible mother. My son has raised the alarm. He is desperately pushing my stomach away from him. On Monday, I wake up and spend about an hour in alternation between vomiting and breathless whimpering. With tap water, I rinse away far more food than I could have eaten. I am afraid to open my mouth and taste air. Air tastes like grease. Air tilts my stomach until it spills yet more. I prop up my legs on the closed toilet seat and lean my head against the sink so that the bathroom is holding me. At some point, Aaron comes and ties my hair up in a high knot, rinses my face gentle with warm water. For some reason, he checks the whites of my eyes. Then he wraps himself around me and hugs me. He goes away when I mutter, "Go away," and vomit over his shoulder. On Tuesday, I buy a pregnancy test, and two blue windows have me wincing. They tell me my son is coming. He is coming, yes, out of my inconsistency, my irregular approach to pill popping, which bores me. He is coming, my son, from an inaccurately remembered chat about the rhythm method in sex education lessons at my Catholic school. The church doesn't want the rhythm method to work, of course it doesn't. Babies, hooray, and so on. My son. I don't even know where I got the idea of him from. When I was 5, I discussed him with Mommy. And because I was years away from having a period, she laughed and humored me, suggested names, until I seemed to forget about it. I didn't forget about it. I just didn't talk about it. I realized quickly that people would think I was crazy if I seemed too convinced that I was due a son. But I just knew. I fast-forwarded over the process of getting a son. I had vague ideas about one day having to do something large and bloody, put my eye out or split my forehead open. And instead, I just had my boy. Warm, alive, walking beside me, gaining strength from me. He was full of laughter, and he wanted me to be happy, and so I was. My brother Thomas was born when I was 9, and I loved him straight away, curiously and wholly in my imagination, with the kind of affection that one doesn't touch for fear of breakage. Because he was a quiet baby and gave my parents less night trouble than I had given them, I watched Thomas for cot death when my parents were asleep. Sometimes Thomas saw me. I wonder what he saw. A big face flitting over him, mouth open for suction, searchlight eyes picking out his breath. I wonder if it seemed I had come to kill him. Babies are not trusting. Thomas mewed at me the first few times I broke sleep to visit him. Then he just watched me back or slept. Thomas was in no way my son. He designated himself Papi's son. I think the real reason why Thomas learned to walk was because of his need to keep track of our Papi. There are photographs of Thomas determinedly weaving along behind Papi. Papi slowing down and looking back, rapt at this tiny beauty who places a firm hand on the back of his knee, gathering the trouser material into a peak in his fingers, not as a restriction, but as a reminder. Papi would say to him jocularly, "Thomas, Thomas, tea boy." But my brother wouldn't respond to that kind of talk. They thought Thomas might be autistic, but he wasn't autistic. He was just serious. Already he was serious. Sometimes Papi and Chebeya called Thomas the London baby. But before Thomas, when Papi, Chebeya, and I were in our Hamburg house, I was a sleepwalker. I went to bed with everyone else, fell asleep, tottered in circles around the house, and woke up to the sound of early morning bicycle bells and wheels soft shooting over paved stone. I woke wherever I had dropped in exhaustion, curled in a ball under the kitchen table with my long nightie dragged down longer and wound around my numb feet. Mummy took the opportunity to ask me if we had rats. She thinks that a house at night is a kingdom of rats. I wasn't in any position to notice rats. But when I started sleeping normally, I remembered that two silent girls had been there with me when I sleepwalked. They never let me go outside, never let me take down the bolts Chebeya so fastidiously fastened every night. The girls detained me with their small fuzzy cells, embraces, smiles, their scent. We played hide-and-seek, but they were always easy to find because they smelled of my mother. They were completely bald, heads smooth and deep brown, small boned faces with eye sockets like vast copper settings for their frozen amber eyes. They saw me and their pupils dilated as if darkness had just fallen, as if I was their endarkenment. Often the girls were wet, their clothes soaked through even when the weather outside was dry. I communicated to them about my son. I can't remember who told what to whom, but I never said anything to my mommy about the girls. She would have had me exercised or something. She keeps saying that when it came to being born, I was a difficult one to persuade. She miscarried twice, early in each pregnancy. When she told me about the miscarriages, I felt accused. I said, "It's not my fault." And Chebeya shrugged. Okay, so that's your introduction to Maha. And now I'm going to read... Let's see if I can find it. Yeah, okay. Part of the story is about Maha's fear that because she's pregnant, she has this other side to her that she calls her hysteric. And she's worried that that she might in some way harm her baby or harm herself because this hysteric is so strong and she has no control over it. And it's like this kind of dark and destructive side of her personality. So I'm just going to read about her trying to explain what the hysteric is. Like every girl, I only need to look up and a little to the right of me to see the hysteria that belongs to me, the one that hangs on a hook like an empty jacket and flutters with disappointment that I cannot wear her all the time. I call her my hysteric, and this personal hysteric of mine is designer-made, though I'm not sure who made her, flattering and comfortable, attractive even if you're around people who like that sort of thing. She is not anyone, my hysteric. She is blank, electricity dancing around a filament, singing to kill. It is not that there are two Mahas, there is only one, but she can disappear into her own tension and may one day never come back. My second ever boyfriend, frizzy, blonde-haired and built like a rugby player, was a postgraduate student 5 years older than me when I was in my first year. Luke seemed to prefer my personal hysteric to me. He told me over and over that I was beautiful, sweet, so clever. In his mouth, on his tongue, those words were not safe. And he said these terrible things earnestly enough to make me sit on my hands when I was across from him at dinner. In his mouth, on his tongue, those words cast a spell which conjured me into the things he kept insisting I was. Luke was always pleading with me to calm down before I realized that I was unsettled. I stopped daring to raise my voice at him or smile too much even. Luke filled bedtime mugs for me, brimful with creamy white, warm Kahlua and milk. When I sipped them sleepily from the enfoldment of his arms, I became convinced that I was ill and that it was terminal. There was no other reason for such care, for the way he laid hands on me so lightly that it seemed I was already disappearing. One night, drunk, I dropped my empty shot glass and a full one for Luke, sat down beside the pieces and arranged them in my skin, twisting clear flowers planted to grow from my soles, my arms. It hurt. But wearing my hysteric, it became a matter of art and pain and so on. It was extreme. It was because of tension. Luke took me to the emergency room and spoke to me richly, quietly, held me for as long as he could while I cried and put my sight away from my torn skin. We went to a girls' school, Amy, Elaney, and I. We know about subtle, slow murder, the way that glances and silences and unnecessarily kind words can have a girl running into traffic trying to get hit so that she doesn't have to turn up the next day. When Amy Elaney arrived at the hospital, she was in no mood for pleasantries. She took Luke aside and told him to fuck right off, immediately. Luke became typical. He called Amy Elaney a man-hating dyke, and she made some movement towards him, some movement that scared him. It was as if she was going to pincer his testicles, and he thought she'd do it, so he shrank. When she told me about it, her voice rose and fell, bitter and sad. Amy Elaney told me gossip about Luke as I waited to be allowed to go home. One girl had said to her, "Luke only goes out with nutters, but he's never been out with a black girl before, so she must be extra psychotic." My hysteric smells foreign, like perfumed sand, but maybe that's how she's supposed to smell. She is not part of me, but part of my store. In times of need, she converts into my emergency image of Chebea, a poorly done portrait that I can show people when I need to ask, "Have you seen this woman?" I have no natural sensitivity. I am forced to this. For a boyfriend from the Ivory Coast, handsome and strong like a mined mineral, I cut off all my hair. Because he said he preferred me like that, all long neck, bare ears, and hopeful eyes. I hated my hair like that, hated it almost too much to live. When I wasn't with him, I spent a lot of time crying. Chabea, who sometimes is my mind outside of me, said musingly, "You look like a boy with that haircut. Your nose, it takes over the middle of your face when there's no hair to look at. It's strange, because in actuality, your nose isn't that big." Amy Elaney only said, "It will grow. Your hair always grows really fast." But I had to keep cutting away new growth with scissors. When this boy broke up with me, he said he was unhappy that I didn't seem to love my hair in its natural state. I asked him, "Is its natural state short?" He just said he had to go. I ran a bath. The hysteric came, and I was persuaded to try and drown myself. But Amy Elaney phoned, and I realized I wanted to answer the phone just a little bit more than I wanted to die. Amy Elaney gets it. When I first tried to describe the hysteric to her, she snorted and said, "You can't speak for everyone. My personal hysteric walks three paces behind me at all times, and when things get a bit much, I kind of hang back, and she kind of hurries forward, and she jumps on my back and takes me down. Then she stands up in my place." I said I didn't like that idea. I said it sounded like a denial of responsibility, a denial that Amy Elaney was underneath her hysteric. "I am underneath her," Amy Elaney said. "She has her fucking stilettos digging into my spine." When Amy Elaney isn't doing well, her thoughts ignore her and come out exactly the way they want to. One summer, her mother went to Cyprus without her, even though Amy Elaney wanted to go so much. But Despina was punishing her because of a bad school report. We were in Amy Elaney's bedroom at her parents' house, and she was sitting on the broad window ledge with her curls squashed against the glass, her hands clawing the window as if she was trying to hold her house upright. She said insistently through gritted teeth, "Do you aid me with my pulse, which has gone away?" She said it a few times before I heard the words. I can't remember her expression. Instead, I think of redness. But if she had punched the window, she would only have hurt herself. When we were 14, Amy Elaney decided that she and I should be friends. Before that, she wouldn't talk to anyone she didn't want to talk to. She was a bit dangerous. She ate lunch by herself, as if lunchtime for the packed lunch students wasn't all about setting up a circle of chairs in the school hall for your group, as if lunchtime wasn't about showing that you had a group. She placed her chair near the center of the hall so that she faced outward, looking toward the door, and she sat cross-legged on it, eating interesting-looking food that didn't match her precise English features. Flat pita sandwiches filled with grilled chicken, cold stuffed vine leaves, squares of honeyed pastry, pomegranates. She ate daintily and with a calm that said she couldn't be bothered with the likes of us. At lunchtime, I always struggled with Chabea sandwiches. Like all her food, Mommy's sandwiches are works of slow-cooked love. They're ostentatious and difficult to eat in public. By the time you curl your fingers around one and take a bite, the marinated pork or chicken is already spilled out from atop the bread, and a shower of sandwich and salsa spatters your hands on your lap. You can't even lick your fingers as you were leaning on the table at home because you feel guilty, you feel embarrassed, you feel mad to have brought in such a luxury bed of a sandwich when everyone else is making do with the equivalent of string hammocks. Amy Eleni was probably equal to the challenge of a Chabea sandwich. I have never seen her blush. She made no attempt to customize her uniform. She just let it hang off her in limp monochrome. Her hair was longer then. She let it all curl into a big, burnt yellow shock, thick enough for me to pile up on her head later in a crown of Senegalese twists. But at that time, everyone, including me, ignored her insistence on being addressed at all times as Amy Eleni. We just kept calling her Amy, which sometimes forced her to shout, "Die before your parents do!" and slap her rump in the direction of the person who was disregarding her wishes. The rumors about her were numerous, but the predominant one was that Amy had three boyfriends and was having sex with all of them on a timetabled basis. One day, Amy Eleni, her most devastating smile in place, beckoned me away from the center of my lunch circle, where I'd been sitting with one foot up on the edge of another girl's chair, laboriously washing pink varnish over her fingernails. I went over to Amy Eleni with the nail varnish still in my hand, and she took it from me and screwed the lid back on. The first thing she told me, with breathtaking serenity, was that we should be best friends, because we were both pretty, and pretty girls always found it difficult to make real girlfriends who wouldn't turn Judas on them. The second thing she told me was that I absolutely had to call her Amy Eleni. Eleni was her middle name, but she took her Cypriot heritage seriously and found it hard enough to keep it up when she looked like a common or garden variety English kid, and had a surname like Lang. Then she mentioned that at her Holy Communion she had spat out the host into her hand because she didn't believe in all that Jesus crap, and that the following Saturday she had snuck back into the church while the priest was taking confession and had tried to make the figurine of the baby Jesus beat upon a drum to prove his reality. She'd then broken the figurine because it hadn't. I stared at her and smiled, timid, aghast. She burst out laughing. She named a book and said I really needed to read it. Our favorite film is Vertigo. Amy Eleni and I must watch it 17 or 18 times a year, and with each viewing, our raptness grows looser and looser. We don't need the visuals anymore. One or the other of us can go into the kitchen halfway through and call out the dialogue while making up two cups of Horlicks. From the minute you see empty, beautiful, blonde Madeline Elster, you know she is doomed, because she exists in a way that Scotty, the male lead, just doesn't. You know that Madeline is in big trouble because she's a vast wound in a landscape where wounds aren't allowed to stay open. People have to shut up and heal up. She's in trouble because the film works to a plan that makes trauma speak itself out, speak itself to excess until it dies. This film at the peak of its slyness, when people sweat and lick their lips excessively and pound their chests and grab their hair and twist their heads from side to side, performing this unspeakable torment. When things are serious, and either Amy Eleni or I need to beat our personal hysteric, the informal code is to seize your head and twist coils of your hair around your fingers and groan, "I'm not mad. I'm not mad. I don't want to die." And if you have a friend who knows, then the friend grabs her head too and replies, "But there's someone inside of me, and she says I must die." That way, it is stupid and funny and serious. Our hysteric is the revelation that we refuse to be consoled for all this noise, and for the attacks on our softnesses, the loss of sensitivity to my scalp with every batch of box braids. Sometimes we cannot see or hear or breathe because of our fright that this is all our bodies will know. We're scared by the happy, hollow discipline that lines our brains and stomachs if we manage to stop eating after one biscuit. We need some kind of answer. We need to know what that biscuit tin discipline is, where it comes from. We need to know whether it's a sign that our bones are turning against the rest of us, whether anyone will help us if our bones win out, or whether the people who should help us will say, "You look wonderful," instead. Why can't we kill this panic, or do the other thing, and make it mute? That's it.
Folks, we're going to have people running around with microphones. If you hold your hand up, we'll get a mic to you. And please wait for it. Any questions for Helen? Thanks, Helen. It was a lovely... Oh, no?
Thanks.
Yes, over here on our left.
Why do you feel the need to go to Columbia this fall to study creative writing?
Well, I feel as if I made a big leap from writing the first novel to this one. And I just feel like I need some kind of incentive or help to make another leap as big for the third one, which I'm writing now. So, I mean, it would help. And I think that these kind of creative writing courses and stuff, they teach you tricks that very quickly that you would only learn in approximately like 7 or 8 years of like reading by yourself. So hopefully like shortcuts, but also because I want to teach writing and it will give me the qualification. So, yeah.
Next question. Gentlemen, all the way. Sir, can you keep your hand up, please?
What is your background? Where do you come from originally?
I was born in Nigeria, but my parents moved to England when I was 4 and brought me with them. What?
That's the whole story. Another question. All the way over here on our left again. Ma'am, can you keep your hand up, please? Thanks.
What was your inspiration for writing this novel?
I picked up a book of Cuban legends, and I was reading about various gods and stuff, and I realized that they were actually Yoruba gods that had been translated into a Cuban context. And that got me thinking about how, well, when I researched it more, I found out that Santeria, it's kind of an expression of what it's like to be a black Cuban, just a sense of trying to maintain identity in a culture that's partially hostile to the original country that you came from, which is in this case like parts of West Africa. So I got really interested in that, and then in like the personal stories as well of immigrants and the immigrant experience. And like the girl in my book, she's removed from Cuba and she's removed from Nigeria, so it's like twice removed, and now she's in London and she's trying to like make sense of herself. So I kind of connected with that.
Do you know how the Yoruban mythology made its way to Cuba?
It came with the slaves. They basically wanted to maintain the Yoruba religion, but because the Spanish like overlords insisted that they be Catholic, they kind of found cunning ways of fusing the Yoruba religion with Catholicism. So they'd like take a saint and give it the nature of a Yoruba god as well. So they'd be secretly worshipping their gods like in this really sneaky and cool way.
And we keep the same name, though.
Yeah.
Another question, right here on the aisle.
Would you talk a little bit about the role of Tilly Tilly in the Icarus Girl? I mean, I read it and I loved the book, but I'm not sure with a sensibility that doesn't have the mythology in it that I quite understand what her role was. If you would talk about that a little bit.
The role of Tilly Tilly. I don't think that she has so much of a mythological role, really. I think it's more her connection to Jess. So she's kind of Jess's best friend, Jess's sister replacement, Jess's tormentor. Like, she's everything to Jess at one point because Jess really feels this need to, like, depart from reality. And so she latches on to Tilly Tilly, which is... And Tilly Tilly kind of represents everything that is not in Jess's life. Yeah. What did you think of her? Were you scared? Yay! Because I hoped to give some people a good scare with that.
She terrified me because I think we all have some piece of that in us, but it can't.
Yeah, she scared me too when I was writing her.
In the maroon, about 6 rows back here. Yes, the gal with the glasses here in the maroon.
I'm quite curious about what authors do you like? Who do you like to read? I'm sorry if that's a terrible question.
No, it's not. It's just a really difficult one because there are always people that I wish that I'd said later when I go home and stuff. I guess the earliest writer that really, really affected me was Louisa Alcott. I remember reading Little Women and just going, oh. And then I read like all her other books, hoping that Joe and Laurie were going to get married, and then they didn't, and I was so upset. But then I also love like Wilkie Collins and Dickens and the Brontes and Thackeray and all those guys. Emily Dickinson, obviously, like I love her so much. Edwidge Danticat, Marg Atwood, Stephen King, I like him a lot, and Poe. Really? Oh, that's cool. Thank you.
Any more questions? Right, Allison, right here in front.
You spoke of a Nigerian author, Bachi.
Buchi Amuchasa.
Yes. Can you tell me a little bit, or tell us a little bit about?
She is. I think she might be just a bit younger than Chinua Achebe and stuff, and I never really understand why she's not as like kind of lionized, because she's immense. She kind of writes to the first wave of Nigerian women immigrants to London, and just like this kind of completely hostile closed world. I think like one of her first books in this kind of series is called Second Class Citizen, and that's very much kind of the ethos of it. Kind of this woman, she's trapped in a marriage to a man that she married in Nigeria who brought her over, and you know, now she's got a visa with him, but she can't really leave him, because if she leaves him, then the visa doesn't cover her anymore. And she's trying to write, and he doesn't care. And like at one point she comes back and he's completely destroyed the manuscript that she was writing, and you're just like, oh my god, like she just really makes you feel, your heart just sinks so much. And she kind of takes you, she takes you up and she takes you down, and she kind of has this very simple, a kind of deceptively simple style. And she's also one of the only writers that both my mum and I really love. Like, she kind of connects us in that way. Because my mum will be like, oh, I'm reading something. And I'll be like, what is that? And she'll be like, it's Richard Emesha, you won't like her. And I'm like, oh, but I do. And then, you know, stuff like that. So, she's great, basically.
Another question? Gentleman back here.
This one? Yeah. I was going to ask you also about your influences and who you like to read, but to follow up on that, I was just wondering whether you feel how do you feel as perhaps being part of the new generation of immigrant writers? I'm thinking of, in particular, Zadie Smith, who I really like, and I've read. She's just an amazing writer, and it's just so full of phantasmagoric type images and stuff, and just a whole miasma of immigrants from all over, and white teeth, and then of course in the second novel on beauty, the mix of races and backgrounds and all that kind of stuff. I'm just curious about your thoughts on that.
I don't know, I always kind of get a bit sort of, whenever someone says that a writer belongs to a particular group, because I always feel like writers shouldn't belong to anybody. So the whole immigrant writer thing, I don't really know what that means. Because I guess writers are all so different. Like even nowadays, people are kind of talking about this kind of new wave of Nigerian writing, and I just don't see it. Like, I don't see that there's a common Nigeria that people are writing about. I think writers are just writers, and they're just saying whatever they need to say. I hope that kind of answers your question vaguely.
Folks, we have time for a few more questions, if there are any on our right. Lady in back here, in the black and the white.
I'd like to know how old you are, and have you considered teaching a writing class for younger people?
Yeah. I'm 22. But by the time I get qualified, I'll be 24, and that will make me like a grand old person. So hopefully I'll be confident enough to teach writing classes.
Folks, right here.
I guess along the whole line of the immigrant writer thing, you moved to England when you were just 4 years old, but I guess how do you feel like you're shaped by being the child of immigrants? I mean, you're an immigrant yourself, but you were so young. Because I was surprised to see what seems like such a strong connection to Nigeria still. And, I don't know if You can just talk about that.
I think I'm more shaped by the sort of books that I was reading growing up than anything else. I had so much coming at me because I would read anything that I could get my hands on. So it was kind of like Sweet Valley High, Nancy Drew. I just saw the film today. I was like, woo, Nancy Drew. You know, anything. I read so much, and I don't think that it occurred to me that that the fact of being an immigrant was anything that I could write about for quite a long time. I just didn't think it was going to be interesting because I guess once something is your experience, you just think that it's almost everyone's experience in a way, so you don't really realize that it's different. It's something that you can talk about. But I remember reading a book called Yoruba Girl Dancing by Simi Bedford when I was about 12 and just thinking, oh my gosh, this girl's me. It's unbelievable. And in a way that when I was reading all those other books, I didn't really see myself reflected there in any way. And so that was a real shock, and that gave me some food for thought. And I guess then I started kind of processing my experiences like in a writerly sort of way. Nigeria, I don't think it's weird because the whole writing about myth and stuff, I guess is not so much because I feel connected with Nigeria, which I actually don't really, but it's more a way of trying to connect, because I always feel like myth is the easiest and most powerful way into any culture, like more so than food or music. I just think like learning about a people's dreams and their world beliefs kind of lets you in more. So that's kind of my little quest.
We've got time for it. We'll take this gentleman right here. One last question.
Hi. I was wondering, you mentioned in the reading of the second beginning or the first
reading, sorry?
The second beginning or the first beginning?
Yeah, I read the second beginning.
I think you mentioned Achebe. Did you?
I mentioned who, sorry?
Achebe. Of the author of Things Fall Apart?
Yes, sorry. Yes, I did.
Okay, I was just wondering if he had been any kind of influence on you.
No.
No. And what was the reference in the work, in the beginning?
In the beginning, there was
Here, when you were reading that, I'm sure you mentioned his name. Oh, I thought. Maybe I'm crazy.
Oh, no. I was just talking about Buchi Emetita and comparing her to Chinua Achebe saying.
My fault. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, thanks to Helen for coming to Philadelphia, and we'll see you upstairs.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.